I'd like to bring this meeting of House Resources to order. It is Friday, March 18th at 1:05. And present are Representative Wilson, Representative Dick, Representative Gardner, Representative Munoz, Co-Chair Feige, and myself, Co-Chair Seaton. Representative Heron, Kawasaki, and Foster are excused. At this time, I'll remind everybody about their cell phones, myself included. And today we have several items. First, we have three confirmation hearings. That's for Cora Campbell for Commissioner of ADF&G, Michael Smith for the Board of Fisheries, Daniel Seamount is Commissioner of Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And then we will take up House Bill 185, exempt discharges from the use of munitions. And then we will go to the Coastal Zone Management Program, House Bill 106. And our intention for House Bill 106 this afternoon is that we will have the Mr. Gray, who presented to us last time, and we rushed through the end of the slides to come back, and we'll have committee questions. Mr. Balash took ill, so he's not going to be here today. So we will we'll get all our questions that we can answered from the current presentation we have, and then we'll take up the public testimony and department review next week. So is there anything from any of the committee members before we begin? Seeing none, thank you. Cora, Ms. Campbell, would you like to come forward and introduce yourself for the record? And this is a confirmation hearing, so we will be reviewing the qualifications of Ms. Campbell, and then there'll be opportunity for public testimony as well. There can be questions from the committee, but there is not questions from testifiers to the designee. So thank you. Would you go ahead and identify yourself on the record and proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Cora Campbell, and I'm the commissioner designee for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
And Cora, although you have been before us once before, we were. Would you go ahead and review your resume and tell us why you want to be commissioner and those kind of things?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I'm originally from Petersburg. I lived there all of my life except for a few winters when I attended college outside, and the last 4 years when I've been living here in Juneau. I grew up in the fishing industry, commercial fishing. I did that from the time that I was a young kid until the time that I had young kids, at which point it was time for me to get off the deck. During that time, I participated in a number of different fisheries, southeast salmon, seining, gillnetting and trolling, herring gillnetting, crab fisheries, mostly here in southeast Alaska. Also, during the off-season, I worked for a local fishing association based in Petersburg, but that had members that fished in fisheries actually from Ketchikan all the way to, we had some folks participating in the Bering Sea. And my role with that group was to represent the fishermen in the various regulatory forums, so I spent a lot of time at the Board of Fisheries, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and also tracked state and federal legislation. And during that time, I also served on the advisory panel to the North Pacific Council, as well as the advisory panel to the North Pacific Research Board, and focused during my time there on economic development and cooperative research projects. After that, I transitioned to working for a statewide organization, and I was administering a program that was focused on outreach and education about subsistence management. This was at the time where management under the Federal Subsistence Board regulations were starting to diverge pretty significantly from state regulations, and this program was focused on providing information about the federal management process and educating Alaskans who might be impacted by those decisions about how to participate in the process and raising awareness. It was about 4 years ago that I went to work in the governor's office. I was originally fisheries policy advisor because that's where my background and expertise primarily was, but in my time there, my responsibilities expanded to include other things, including wildlife issues, issues with the Department of Environmental Conservation, and other issues with natural resources management. So by the time I left the governor's office, I had a fairly broad portfolio and exposure to a number of different departments and issues. I started serving as acting commissioner at the department on December 1st, and that's where I've been since.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Appreciate the diversity of your background. Do committee members have questions for Ms. Campbell? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I've been actually very impressed with you personally, and I think you have a really strong background for this position. But I'm getting calls from people who are concerned that your commercial fisheries background would possibly lead you to be biased in favor of commercial interests and against sport fishing and subsistence users. And I know you have an endorsement from, or your appointment has an endorsement from AFN, but what would you say to those who are concerned about sport fishing and subsistence issues?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, what I would say about that is that although I grew up commercial fishing, I also grew up sport fishing, and of course my family also fishes in personal use fisheries for food. So I actually have exposure to all three types of, all those types of fishing, although my professional experience has largely been in the commercial fishing industry. But when I went to work in the governor's office, I transitioned from working for any particular part of the fisheries to a position with statewide responsibilities, where you're really in a position where you're responsible to and advocating for all constituents and all resource users. And that's the role that I've had for about the past 4 years. I feel like it's something that I've done successfully. I've established relationships with sport fishing groups, with subsistence users, and I'm comfortable working in a fair and balanced manner.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you aware of the program where Bristol Bay drift fishermen are all charged a 1% tax for a fisheries developer?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Feige, yes, I'm aware of it.
Okay. Can you explain how an advocacy organization like, say, Trout Unlimited is given grants from these tax collections for marketing work? And what kind of oversight does the Department of Fish and Game have to verify that these monies are used properly?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Feige, actually, I don't believe we have any oversight responsibility over regional seafood development associations. They are incorporated under statutes and regulations for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And so in terms of direct responsibility, I don't believe that the Department of Fish and Game has that responsibility.
And follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Feige.
In that case, how does the state decide whether a trout sport fishing group is the best choice to market commercial salmon?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Feige, my understanding of the program is that it's a self-assessment. Fishermen vote to assess essentially a 1% tax on themselves to be used for the purposes of development for their fishery. They then elect a board of directors from among those folks who are paying the taxes, and my understanding is that the use of those monies is largely directed by that board of directors. So I don't know to what extent the regulations that Commerce has may direct appropriate uses of those funds, but that's my understanding of how those decisions are made within those programs.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had the honor of knowing Cora for quite some time now. She used to be a constituent of mine, but I still, every time I see her, feel like she still is. But I have really watched her grow, you know, from 11 years ago until now. And I really feel that she's very, very capable of being the commissioner. I know her personally, and the fact that she's fair and honest, I just trust that she will be able to do a good job. So that's all I have to say. I don't have any questions for her, but I feel pretty strongly about that.
Do we have further questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Dick.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Coral, one of the things that impresses me is that when you were first announced as the commissioner, there was some opposition, and yet I have here letters of people saying they've, you know, turned around 180 degrees and they support you firmly. So that's really impressive for me that you're able to change a lot of people's minds. And I don't at all mean to put you on the spot here, but we know that the state constitution says it will manage wildlife for sustained yield. And in the past, there's been issues raised, particularly with my constituents, in terms of predator control. And I was wondering, do you feel that the current policies and the way fishing, we're dealing with predator control, do you think that's aggressive enough? Do you think it's needs to be more aggressive? Or what are your views on that, Cora?
Through the chair, Representative Dick, I believe that the department has made a shift over the past several years to be more active in their management and to try to refine those intensive management programs. We are starting to see the results of those efforts in a number of areas, but we're not to the abundance levels that we would like to be in many areas, including some of the areas that you represent. So while I embrace the philosophy that the Division of Wildlife Conservation has, that those programs are appropriate, we do still have some challenges. One of those is that in areas where there is a patchwork of state and federal lands, we do not at this time, with some federal landowners, we do not have their cooperation in those programs. That's a significant impediment to us because certainly the moose and caribou do not know where the lions are, and neither do the wolves. So anyway, we are still working to try to establish some type of cooperation with some of the federal land managers to allow more programs to take place, and we are still working to refine those management programs.
Follow-up, Representative Dick, or is that? Okay, thank you. And then Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. Thank you, Cora. Here in Juneau, we've heard a lot of discussion around the Taku River and the possibility of barging from Canada and how it might affect the bottom of the river. A large group of property owners feel strongly that we should not go forward with the critical habitat designation, and another group of primarily fishermen believe that a critical habitat is the right approach to protect the river from possible effects of the barging. Could you comment on your feeling about the critical habitat program and whether that is the most effective means for protecting the river bottom? And could you also comment on the issue of barging as it relates to an international riverway and what our options are as a jurisdiction in protecting that resource?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, while I don't necessarily want to take sides in the debate that your constituents are having right now about whether or not a critical habitat area is the right approach to protect that river, I do understand the concern that people are expressing about some activities that have been and could be in the future proposed on the river. I guess I would say a couple of things about that. One is that we feel fairly confident in the authorities that we have now, that those give us the authority that we need through the permitting process to protect the river and the river bottom and the salmon habitat that is there. But I understand that not everybody shares that level of comfort. And I guess the other thing I would say about it is that really a critical habitat designation can have a lot of flexibility. The legislature has very broad discretion to talk about what types of activities would and would not be allowed in that area. And so it's likely that there's a mechanism through legislative discretion to address some of the concerns people could have about that being overly restrictive.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you, Cora. We'll go to public testimony if you would remain in. Is there anyone in the audience who is here to testify on? Okay, thank you. We'll go to the phone lines. If you would remember on the phone to please state your name, who you're representing. You can raise issues or support or oppose, but please remember that we are talking about personalities here, and we're not getting into, objections based on personal feelings and those kind of things. So first we'll go to Steve Flory. Stephen Flory, are you there in Anchorage?
Yes, sir, I am.
Yes, would you identify who you're representing and proceed with your testimony?
Mr. Chairman, today I'm representing the Anchorage Advisory Committee. The Anchorage Advisory Committee took a vote shortly after Cora Campbell was nominated, and we voted to fully endorse her completely, unanimously. This is to include both sides of the fish and game debate on both commercial and non-commercial fish, sport fish, and members of the non-hunting community. So we fully endorse her. We, after talking with three different members, have had discussions, and we feel that what she doesn't already know, she's willing to learn, and she's open to new ideas and discussing it with the general public and the advisory committees in a whole. So she has our full endorsement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flory. And before we go to the next testifier, I wanted to recognize that Representative Tammy Wilson has been in the audience with us. So thank you. Ricky Geese, are you online?
Yes, my name is Ricky Geese. I'm the executive director of Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. And we've had the pleasure of working with Commissioner Campbell first in her capacity as the fisheries advisor in the governor's office and now as the commissioner designee for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. She's very smart. She's articulate. She's been very approachable on issues. She makes time to meet with stakeholders and members of the public. She's willing to listen to concerns and then works very responsibly to seek a resolution if one is warranted. She has our endorsement for Commissioner of Fish and Game from Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Geese. Next is Ruben Hanke.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to speak this afternoon. My name is Ruben Hanke. I live in Soldotna, Alaska. I've had the chance to work with Cora Campbell over the last couple of years at the fisheries level in the governor's office, and I've also had the same some interactions with her at the Board of Fisheries level. She's been very approachable and willing to listen to all sides of fish and game issues, and I think that she's going to make a great commissioner, and I look forward to working with her in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ruben. And would you identify, are you representing yourself or an organization this afternoon?
Mr. Chair, I'm representing myself. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's now go to Fairbanks. Wayne Hyman.
Yes, my name is Wayne Heimer.
Heimer.
So I live here in Fairbanks. I'm testifying for myself. I'm testifying in support of Ms. Campbell as the nominee. The reason I'm testifying in her support is that I worked for the department for 25 years and watched every kind of commissioner that came through during that time. In the 12 years since I left the department, I've watched those that have come along, and I've concluded that the personality of the commissioner is less important than the philosophy of the governor with whom he or she serves. I'm very supportive of Governor Parnell's philosophy and his agenda and the good people that Ms. Campbell has working for her. I'm particularly pleased with Corey Rossi and Craig Fleener as executives in wildlife. I don't have a lot of experience in fisheries, but I do have one more comment, if I may, about Mr. Smith.
We'll be taking up that confirmation next.
Okay, I'll wait. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now go to Craig Campo.
Yes, Campo, thank you. I'd like to, as I'm speaking for SFW Alaska, that's Sportsmen for Wildlife Alaska, as a founding board member, we wholeheartedly endorse Cora Campbell for the commissioner of Fish and Game. We've been very impressed with her decisive action and the fact that she hears both sides of the story. She seems to be willing to work with folks and take decisive action when it's necessary, even early in her career as the commissioner. As a 50-year resident of Alaska, specifically Fairbanks, I've watched at least for 25 years a lot of the commissioners with much thicker resumes than Ms. Campbell that have very, in my opinion, poorly performed in relation to wildlife populations and abundance management and things of this nature. I, like Mr. Heimer, don't have a lot of experience on the fish side, but we've been very impressed with her and her ability to work with these user groups, and we wholeheartedly endorse Cora Campbell.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Now we'll go to Julianne Curry in Petersburg.
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton and members of the Health Resources Committee. My name is Julianne Curry. I'm the Executive Director of the Petersburg Best Loaners Association. Over 100 members with multi-gear and multi-species fishing from Ketchikan to the Bering Sea, and we participate in most fisheries throughout Southeast Alaska. I'm here to support Cora Campbell, candidate for Commissioner of Fish and Game. Although I really enjoy testifying for individuals I've known personally for a long time, I'm particularly delighted to speak out in favor of Commissioner Campbell due to her unique background in the fisheries management process and also her history with personal participation in not only the commercial fisheries but also the personal use and sport fisheries. We've worked alongside Cora for a long time. She's brilliant, she's articulate, and she understands the need to put the resource first. Her broad range of support is a testament to her ability to manage the department, and I'm just so stinking excited to support somebody who's so young for Commissioner of Fish and Game. We think she'll do great. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And John Jensen, are you there also in Petersburg?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm speaking in favor of Ms. Campbell today. I'm a user of all the state's resources, subsistence hunting and fishing, and I trust Ms. Campbell capabilities with the management of these resources for all the state people, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And were you representing yourself today?
Yes, I was, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's go to Homer. Sarah Jakinski.
Yes, thank you. This is Sarah Jakinski of Homer, and I'm representing myself. And I'm going to urge a vote against confirmation of Cora Campbell as commissioner. The people of Alaska are entitled to the best leadership available in this area, and I'm sure Ms. Campbell is a wonderful person. However, she's not qualified to hold this position. She holds a BA in education. She has no scientific background. She has no research background. She has no conservation background. She doesn't have an education in fisheries issues. She has no statistical background or economic background. She states that she's a commercial fisherman since the 90s, which would put her at about age 10, and we're considering this as a professional resume. I believe that a disappointment would be a slap in the face to those involved in commercial fishing, sports fishing, and subsistence fishing. I think that the people of the state deserve a commissioner who's knowledgeable and who has a background and education in an appropriate area. I think this is a case of who you know, with no regards to the importance of the position, and I strongly urge denial of this confirmation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and we'll stay in Homer. Larry Smith?
Larry is not going to testify.
Okay. And we have Mitchell Hracker. I know I'm messing the name up. H-R-A...
Hey, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. As a scientist with a degree in geology and a social science degree in geography, we were taught trends with statistics to present the data, establish trends based on data, and present answers from that data. Ms. Campbell, with a degree of in education, I believe she doesn't have the background to make sound decisions on a broad spectrum of issues such as complex trends in the ocean environment. The nominee is quoted as wishing to sustain world-class fishing, hunting, wildlife viewing opportunity. I can only hope this nominee has the knowledge and foresight to advise on closures of a fishery or game management area for long-term viabilities. These questions should be asked by legislative bodies. For instance, Cook Inlet, you know, we are experiencing a downturn of halibut with the breeder fish are going out of the inlet, and they're not laying the eggs, and the halibut doesn't seem to be sustainable at this time. Or wildlife viewing at Denali Park, I noticed there are hordes of hunters around the terminus of the park, and to me that states that Cook Inlet and Denali Park are refuges for wildlife. Be interesting to know if she would support closures of breeder halibuts and broader areas around the park too, for buffers to promote wildlife habitat and viewing. The nominee is also from the same university as Governor Parnell, Pacific Lutheran University, with a degree in education. I am hoping this is not the sole criteria for this choice. Faith management, game management is not a science. Thank you for your time to testify.
Thank you. And would you spell your last name, and were you representing yourself today?
Yes, I'm representing myself, and I believe the name should be on the list. The last name is H-R-A-C-H-I-A-R. And one other thing, Paul, is on the governor's press release, we have a copyright. And I'm wondering if the government can actually have the rights to do some copyright on data. And this is becoming an issue with Freedom of Information Act that we are being denied of our rights for open information. Thank you.
Thank you. And it was misspelled on my list here, and I wanted to make sure of that. So thank you for your testimony today. Paul Shadura at Kenai, are you online?
Yes, Representative Seaton, members of the Resource Committee. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Paul A. Shadura II. I reside in Soldotna and within the Kenai Peninsula borough. I wear different hats in the community. Currently, I am on the local AC, an alternate to the Cook Inlet Region Citizen Advisory Committee, and a stakeholder on the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Team, and a member of several commercial fishing advocacy groups. But today I represent myself. My family history includes Russian, English, and Aleut descent. I am considered an Alaska Native and believe that all Alaskans should have the opportunity to serve the people of the state of Alaska. It is not often that we have the opportunity to promote a youthful Alaskan to public service. There is no greater reward to the residents of Alaska than to be guardian of our state's precious fish and game resources. Ms. Campbell has the proven skills as specified in Alaska Statute 1605-10. That is, the commissioner shall be a qualified executive with the knowledge of the requirements for the protection, management, conservation, and restoration of the fish and game resources of the state. My personal experience with Cora has been one that she has consistently shown a keen sense of understanding for her fellow Alaskans. She listens and is respectful. I believe that Ms. Campbell will revitalize the Department of Fish and Game and will continue to attract new expertise into a department that is currently suffering from an exodus of long-time experienced fish and game leadership. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Are there, let's see, is there anyone else there in Kenai?
We have no one else at this time, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll go to Anchorage. Bob Herrich. Do I have that name right?
No, not quite. My name is Bob Herrich. I'm testifying in Anchorage today because I'm up here for medical. I live in Cordova. I was born in Cordova. I have 68 years there, and I was here before there was a Department of Fish and Game. And I'm testifying in support of Cora Campbell for the commissioner's spot. I think she is a breath of fresh air. And I like the fact she's got Corey Rossi and Craig Fleener working there, and I look forward to working for her, with her. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Well, thank you, Bob, for calling in. And the reason we get these wrong sometimes is that transmittal and getting on to our sheets here, sometimes the names are spelled wrong. So, and yours was as well. So you were representing yourself, is that correct, or were you representing an organization?
Well, I'm involved with many organizations. Today I'm speaking for myself.
Okay, thank you very much. And then Gary Olson in Anchorage.
Yes, hello, Gary Olson here. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I am testifying on behalf of myself today. I am the founder of the Alaska Moose Federation. And a couple things I wanted to point it out that need to be pointed out, in my opinion, is with Commissioner Campbell, a couple of the concerns being youth, and also the fact that she does not come from within the fish and game, I look as two attributes at this point. We have a history of a decline of the moose population in Alaska that has affected far too many people. And when looking at the track records for folks that have been involved with us for decades that have the criticism, that is not something to be proud of. So the fact that this is a fresh face and brings new energy and also the people that are surrounding her is to be commended, and full support from Gary Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Is there anyone else online we haven't called? Seeing them, we have one person in the audience, Jerry McClure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska, and I am also president of Cordova District Fishermen United. UFA solely supports CORA for the commissioner. There's 38 different groups from around the state, from southeast of the Bering Sea, and UFA plus four members at large that sit there. So being young, I think, is a plus right now. I've been president of CDFU for 25 years, and I've been around and fishing since I was 9 years old in the Copper River and Prince William Sound. And some of the best ideas I'm getting right now is from our youthful fishermen. They change my mind all the time about new ideas, and so I don't get stuck in my old way. So it's very refreshful, I think, to see somebody's a little younger, and the department's been passed on inside the department for a long time, and a lot of those opinions have never changed in the department, I think. And I think this is a fresh look and a fresh start, and I worked with Cora many years on different things before she was in the governor's office and when she was in the governor's office. And she's very sharp, and she'll do a good job for this state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate your testimony. We'll come back to the committee for discussion. Wait a minute. Was there anyone else in the audience to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony, and we'll come back to the... are there any further questions of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Wilson?
Mr. Chairman, I move Cora Campbell as the appointment for the Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game to the joint session for confirmation.
Is there objection? Seeing none, I want to remind everyone that we have reviewed her qualifications. We've heard public testimony. We are not voting up or down. What we are doing is moving her confirmation to the floor at a joint session for a confirmation vote. So there is no positive or negative votes on any confirmation hearings coming from committees. But seeing no objection to that motion will pass, and we will send her nomination to the floor for consideration. Thank you very much, Ms. Campbell, for coming in. Next, we have Michael Smith. Do we have Mr. Smith online?
Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, we hear you now. Would you go ahead and identify yourself on the record and give us some of your background, let us know some of your resume, and why you would like to serve on the Board of Fisheries? Mr. Smith, are you still there? I think we've got somewhere on mute. Okay, Mr. Smith, if you happen to be watching on TV, you've dropped off of the line here. So,
hello.
Yes, there you are. We lost you. So I don't know what you heard. So I'll just ask you to identify yourself on the record and let us know your resume, some of your background, and why you would like to have the position of a member of the Board of Fisheries.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Smith, and currently I'm the Director of Wildlife and Parks for Tanana Chiefs Conference. In that capacity, my essential role is to advocate for subsistence opportunities on behalf of rural Alaskans. Additionally, my background in fishing arises from my early life on the Yukon River in the village of New Lotto, where I was raised. There we went to fish camp every summer and spent virtually all summer at fish camp, passing on, learning the traditions from our elders, spending time seeing the different species of salmon as they went by and learning the different ways of preparing those fish and stuff. Over the years, after working on the pipeline, I again went fishing, but this time below the Yukon River Bridge, where I was participated in a commercial fishing activity for quite a few years, until such time that the fishery on the Yukon River, as most of you are aware, collapsed. After that, I got involved in advocacy with Tanana Chiefs Conference, and since that time have been involved in more of the, like a lot of good fishermen, we find ourselves wandering into the management and regulatory arena and having to get away from our fisheries activities. But anyway, in that regard, I started attending meetings, AC meetings, and things of that nature. And got heavily involved in fishery activities, primarily on the Yukon River. During that time, I was advisor to the Yukon River Panel, which is the treaty panel for the Yukon River with Canada. Been on the Escape and Goal Committee for the Yukon-Kuskokwim area. I've been on also participated at the North Pacific Council level on their King Salmon Bycatch Committee. I've also participated in other fishing game arenas as well, the Board of Game on their Tier 2 Committee, and I also sit on the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council. So I have gathering a rather wide experience of regulatory and management experience. About 10 years ago, the Yukon River experienced its first crash, and that's where I really started focusing on Yukon River salmon issues and that. And since that time, I've grown quite a bit and learned the process and feel pretty comfortable in being able to represent the the people along the river and in along all of the internal rivers, I guess, in a educated and informed manner now. And I appreciate Governor Parnell's trust in my abilities. And Mr. Chairman, I just I guess that's enough for now.
Okay, thank you very much. Do members have questions for Mr. Smith? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Smith, what would your opinion be of establishing a hatchery in the Yukon River drainage, similar to what we have in Prince William Sound?
Well, hatcheries have been talked about quite often on the Yukon River. For the most part, most of the residents and most of the participants are fairly reluctant to participate in a hatchery at this point. I don't think they see the decline as being significant to have to go to that route yet. I know the hatchery in Whitehorse, everybody knows it's there, but it's limited usage and stuff like that doesn't seem to bother anybody. But I think a hatchery that would that is intended to intentionally supplement the King Salmon Run, I think would probably initially meet some with resistance. And would have to be shown to be really needed to convince the people on the river, I think, at this point.
Okay, thank you. Further questions at this time? We will go to the line here in Wayne Heimer in Fairbanks.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm speaking in support of Mr. Smith. Nomination to the Board of Fisheries. I myself am not a big-time fisheries guy, but I have heard Mr. Smith make a number of presentations and am convinced that he understands the Yukon River about as well as anyone. He can work with any number of groups of people, and I think he brings a perspective to the Board of Fisheries which has been lacking, so I support his nomination.
Thank you. And would you state your name and who you're representing for our record?
Yes, my name is Wayne Heimer. I'm representing myself.
Okay. Thank you very much, Wayne. And we have Craig Campo. Are you there as well?
I am. Thank you, sir. I am representing myself today. My name is Craig Campo, a 50-year resident of Fairbanks. I'm heavily involved in sportsman's issues and wildlife issues and in Fairbanks, and have had a chance over the last 3 to 4 years to watch Mike Smith in action at meetings, testimony. I've been very impressed with his professionalism and his ability to gather information and make sound decisions based on issues relating mostly to fisheries, the Yukon River fisheries, as well as other issues. I've met with Mike in meetings with the National Park Service on issues we had. Our group has had, and he's been extremely articulate, very, very well informed, and carries a very powerful message that I think would be wonderful for the folks along the river, all the rivers, especially the Yukon River in the state of Alaska. I would strongly endorse Mike Smith for this position. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony today. And we had Reuben Henke in. Soldatna, are you still online, Reuben?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
We sure can. Would you go ahead, though, and restate your name and who you're representing for the record?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reuben Henke. I live in Soldatna, Alaska, and I'm representing myself. I've known Mr. Smith for several years and think he will do an excellent job on the Board of Fish. I have attended several of the meetings Mike has been involved with to date, and he has done a great job. Mr. Smith is well-rounded, approachable, and understands the complex fisheries of Alaska, and I think he will do an excellent job on the Board of Fisheries. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify on Mr. Smith for position of the Board of Fisheries? Is there anyone else online?
Here in Anchorage, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, in Anchorage, would you identify yourself, name, and who you're representing for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Flory. I'm representing the Anchorage Advisory Committee. In the past, I have been its chair and have had the opportunity to serve with Mr. Smith on several subcommittees of different organizations, different times with Board of Game, Board of Fish, the Pacific Management Council. As the last testifier said, that he's been well-rounded, and I have to echo that. I have to tell you that me and Mike have not always seen eye to eye on every subject, but he has listened. He seems to be articulate. He does his homework, which, quite frankly, for those of us who sit on ACs and attend the board meetings, is always a fresh feeling, because we have a lot of times we end up going to these Board of Game and Board of Fish where we don't feel the individuals are well studied in what they're actually talking about. Mr. Smith always shows up prepared. He always shows up with a fair understanding and willing to listen to other points of view. As I've mentioned, I've dealt with him multiple times in both arenas, both Game, Board of Fish stuff, and it's always good to see the governor designate somebody who has a thorough understanding of the process. So many times we get political appointees who don't have any understanding of the process, and after sitting there for 3 years, they still don't have an understanding. The nicest thing about Mike Smith is he's ready to hit the ground running, which is what this state really needs. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Flory. And just for clarification, you were representing yourself in this testimony or the AC?
The Anchorage Advisory Committee. We also gave him a unanimous endorsement.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Is there anyone else online who would like to testify on the nomination of Mike Smith for Board of Fisheries? Seeing none, a closed public testimony. Are there...
Mr. Chairman, this is Mike Smith.
Yes, Mr. Smith, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I find myself in kind of an awkward position here. As I mentioned earlier, I'm also the director of Wildlife and Parks for Canada Chiefs Conference, and we wanted to offer our full endorsement of Ms. Campbell for the Commissioner of Fish and Game. Now, TCC represents 42 interior communities, and we, of course, always have concerns about new commissioners of Fish and Game, considering we've been through over the years. And we initially had some concerns about Ms. Campbell. But in sitting down and meeting with her and having some in-depth conversation and being thoroughly impressed with her knowledge and her willingness to listen to our concerns, and we believe her willingness to protect the subsistence way of life in Alaska as mentioned in statute, we wanted to offer our full endorsement of her for the spot of commissioner, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. And do we have other questions for Mr. Smith? Any further? No? Let's see. I guess I would just say that a congratulations on if you were serving on the advisory panel of the North Pacific Fisheries Association that was able to finally get a cap on through the North Pacific Council cap on king salmon catches in the Gulf of Alaska. That's something that people have been trying to accomplish for a long time. So not that it was a singular thing by anybody, but there's been several people testify today about being on that advisory committee to the North Pacific Council. So that was just wanted to say that. Representative Wilson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move that Michael Smith, who has been appointed the appointment to the Board of Fisheries, be moved forward to the joint session for confirmation.
Okay, and seeing no objection, Mr. Smith's name will be forwarded to joint session for consideration. Now we will move, and thank you for joining us online, Mr. Smith. Now we will go to... Daniel Seamount, Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And we'll take just a brief of these. And again, you're up for confirmation for Commissioner of Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I believe you had a few slides to go through with us on the commission, and presenting your resume as well, and why you want to be on this commission. So would you just identify yourself on the record and go ahead and proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Daniel Seamount. I would first start off to say that I'd like to thank the committee for giving me the opportunity to present my case, to keep a really, really, really interesting, challenging, and fun job that I've been doing for the last 11 years. You've got my resume and my bio in front of you, and I understand you want me to go through a summary of what the commission does, so I'll do that, and I'll try to do it expeditiously. I'll start off by saying something a little bit about myself. I've been the chair and geologic commissioner of the Alaska Oil and Gas Commission for the last 3 years. There are three commissioners on the AOG, AOGCC, Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The other two commissioners, one is John Norman. He's our public commissioner, and he is an outstanding, he's outstanding at oil and gas law. And we have, the other one is Kathy Forrester. She holds the engineering seat, and she's just a genius at petroleum engineering. So I think right now we have a really good team put together. 8 years prior to me being chair, I was the geologic commissioner. Before I get to talking about what the AOGCC does, I'll just finish out by my background. For 27 years prior to government work, I worked in industry, and I worked for three different oil companies plus the University of California. I mainly did oil, gas, and geothermal development and exploration in California, the Rockies, and the Mid-Continent, and both offshore and onshore. I have an MS and a master's degree in geology from the University of California, Riverside. I went at the same time as Representative Gardner went, but she was on the liberal side and I was on the science side. So I don't think we ever met. We might have, but I don't remember. All right, let's go through this presentation. So maybe I can tell you that, or show you that I know something about this commission. The picture up there is a picture of Alpine Oil Field. It's an example of the way an oil field should be developed. It's got a very small footprint, and the footprints are going smaller and smaller as time goes on. You could probably develop all of ANWR with just maybe six small pads out there, minus the facilities and stuff like the pipelines. Kathy Forrester has a much better picture for the opening slide, and that is a picture of the old Firestone tire shop that we have converted into our office. My office is in bay number 3. We're very it's at a great location. We have we're right behind Nordstrom's. Shea Ritz is in the same building as us. And Bernie's Bungalow Martini Bar is right across the street. So we have something for everybody there, and you're always welcome to come by. We are a quasi-judicial state regulatory agency. We mainly have oversight for underground oil and gas operations. We hold our area that we regulate is the same as the troopers, so we exercise police power throughout the state. Means we have authority over federal lands, state lands, native and private. And we basically regulate the drilling and production for oil, gas, and geothermal resources. Geothermal was just given to us last year. The next slide, number 3, Our mission is to prevent the waste of energy resources. It's oil, gas, geothermal. We promote greater ultimate energy resource recovery. We make sure that the industry's plans get the most resource that can be gotten out of the ground, avoiding as much waste of the resource as possible. Equally important, we protect underground fresh water from damage caused by oil, gas, and geothermal operations. We protect human safety on drilling and a lot of the production operations, and we protect the rights of owners of oil, gas, and geothermal leases to recover their fair share of the resource. Our jurisdiction, as I said, is oil, gas, geothermal. We've been getting into underground storage of natural gas. It's a very important issue in South Central Alaska right now. And the one thing we do that's above the ground is we make sure that meters are accurate for custody transfer. These are the types of permits we put out. Since I've been there, we've evaluated and approved more than 2,300 drilling permits, more than 4,000 well workover permits. We've done 46 underground injection orders. That would include enhanced oil recovery, waste disposal, and there's a few gas storage that we've done recently. We've done hundreds of conservation orders. Major orders would include pool rules and setting up the rules for developing of reservoirs within oil fields. And then we do have some special development, some special considerations. We do some dispute adjudication between owners, and those have been some of our most contentious hearings. One of them went for 9 days, and it went through to the Supreme Court, and we finally won after 5 years. But we have never lost a case against us, and the lawyers tell me don't say that because you're just jinxing yourself. But I said that, and then we won two right after I said that, and right after the lawyer warned me against it. Okay, our staffing, we have 28 so far. We're going for another engineer, another inspector in light of the Gulf of Mexico disaster, just to, you know, kind of get a little bit more oversight on these operations. We, as I said, we've got three commissioners. We have five petroleum engineers, two petroleum geologists, six field inspectors. We have IT administration and clerical support staff. And everyone, I think just about every one of our engineers, geologists, and inspectors has at least 30 years experience each in their disciplines. We've got a very technical agency, and I understand that right now they're watching this and having a taco party in the office, and my advice to them is get back to work. I found that out, too. Okay. Oh, all right. That's all I'm going to say. And as I've said before, this is a really exciting time to be on the commission. There's things hitting us, you know, every other day that we didn't expect and we couldn't predict, and it's just I think I've gotten addicted to the stress and stuff, and it's if I didn't have this job, I don't know, I'd probably die of boredom. There's no such thing as boredom on this job. I'd like to continue serving the people of this great state of Alaska. And see, there are some challenges. Did I tell you what the challenges we're going through right now?
Is this the hot topic? If you just do the last slide, that's
Oops.
There we
go. Okay, these are some of the hot topics that are going on right now. We've got North Slope gas sales. We've got gas storage issues in South Central. We've got some real energy challenges in South Central Alaska. Of course, we do all over Alaska. And there's 20 basins out there. Only two have ever been produced. And there are 20 basins out there or more that have potential for oil and gas. And a lot of them are in the most of them are in the rural areas. We've got recently geothermal underground coal gasification projects going in that we've never seen before. Like I said before, we're responding to the Gulf of Mexico disaster. There's other things, let's see, like I had a list. Oh, there's LNG, the LNG issues in Cook Inlet. There's jackups coming to Cook Inlet. And it's just, it's an exciting time to be doing this, and I'd like to continue doing it. If it's decided that change is needed, then I offer my help in the transition. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You mentioned 20 basins. Are those, I guess we really haven't seen, a layout of where those are identified. So I'm not on your confirmation hearing, but at some time it would be great if you could send us a map that has those 20 basins outlined. So we, and also if you have some indications on there of why they're not, if it's on federal land and so isn't available for lease, or if it's on, you know, what those issues are around those basins, that would be something that I would find useful.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and the map I would be sending to you would be modified from a DNR map, Oil and Gas Division, and they're a really good source of information on that, the DNR and the DGGS. But if you want to see where those basins are in the next hour or so, there's a map on the wall right down the hall by the elevator, and you can see it's got all those basins there. And I counted them up today before I came in, and I stopped at 20. There are more than 20 basins that have potential in oil and gas.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Mr. Cena. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question, and I don't expect a detailed answer at all, just a general, but because you've gone into all kinds of non-traditional drilling and up on the North Slope, what do you think of fracking?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, fracking has been going on for over 50 years. When I was in industry, I was involved in hundreds of frack jobs with no problems. A lot of what's being said about fracking is total hysteria and overblown. Okay. And it's either out of ignorance or it's out of dishonesty.
Follow up?
No, follow up, Representative Wilson.
Do we have, I know we're not, we can't sell the gas, but I mean, are we doing any of that in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, there are some very, in fact, very large fracks going on at Colville, Alpine Field right now. Okay. Huge fracks, bigger than I ever did when I was in industry. Of course, they've gotten bigger with time.
Okay, thank you.
Are there further questions? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. based on your past experience working for several oil companies, judging by your resume, how many dry holes and failed plays are you responsible for in the state of Alaska?
Mr. Co-Chairman, did John Norman set you up to this?
No.
Okay. I was pretty lucky. I drilled quite a few discoveries. It's mostly luck, I think. But, I've drilled a few dry holes, a few disasters, $12 million disasters.
I'm sure that just adds to your level of experience. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you. We've been informed over the years that the ratio is usually like 1 to 6, where 5 are dry and 1 is wet. What is your experience overall for the total up there? What have you noticed?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, are you talking about just the North Slope?
Yes.
It appears to me that the North Slope has a very high success rate compared to other areas, and it's probably due to new technology and better seismic data. But I think the success rate's been going up everywhere through the years. But I could, a lot of the wells drilled at the North Slope find oil. That's just incredibly oily basin up there. It's the oiliest basin I've ever looked at in North America. But you see a lot of wells get drilled and plugged, but they'll make oil. They'd make a great oil field down south. It's just the infrastructure's not there to support it yet. So it'd be hard to tell you, you know, well, they're not economic successes. And I've had oil company CEOs say if it's not economic, it's not a success. It's not a discovery. But someday those wells will be produced.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you. How long does it take to get a permit through the process, through your process? And how many active permit applications do you have right now?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, you know. We process a drilling permit in 7 days.
Wow.
10 years ago, it was 27 days, and we made that one of our performance measures. So we really never have, well, let's say we have 175 drilling permits a year. So what would that be? That'd be like one every 2 days. So what we have outstanding is like three or four. But they get done really fast. And they're still done, you know, carefully.
Further questions? Representative Munoz.
Have you noticed a decrease in the amount of permits that you're processing now compared to previous years?
To the chair, Representative Munoz. I just gave a presentation on that at House Finances the other day, and I've got a whole bunch of charts that you can look at, and you can make a decision on your own. But drilling, our exploration is way down in the last year, and it's going to be even wayer down next year. Development's been down, activity's been down since 2005. And, you know, I'll send you the presentation, but used to be you could correlate activity with the price of oil, and that just hasn't worked in the last 5 years. I don't know what's going on.
Follow-up, Reverend Moon.
I would appreciate having that presentation. We went through the hearings on HB 110 in this committee, but I don't believe we had a presentation from the commission. I don't believe. No. Thank you.
Okay.
Seeing no further questions, then we'll go to public testimony. Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on Daniel C. Mount for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission? Seeing none, is there anyone online? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony. Does the committee have any further questions? Mr. Seamount.
You're ready for
a motion. Representative Feige.
Mr. Chairman, I move Daniel Seamount, Jr. for appointment to Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to the joint session for confirmation.
Thank you. Is there any objections? Seeing no objections, we will move your name to joint session for consideration. Thank you very much for coming in and the information.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
The next order of business will be House Bill 185. Good afternoon. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, Representative Wilson, and then we will go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tammy Wilson. I'm represented for District 11. And just to make sure that we're on the same page for 185, we have backslash E is the one that we're going to be working off of.
We have Reverend Foggy, did you want to make the motion to bring version E, committee substitute E before us?
Let me see what we're doing. I'd like to make a motion for CS for House Bill 185, that's 27-LS0506/E. Motion to have it be the working document.
Is there any objection? Object for discussion. Would you tell us the difference between this and the previous version?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The agency representatives will more thoroughly explain the reason for this technical change, but basically the change is necessary because a long federal vetting process, which we know if it's federal, it's long, was accomplished, and this is the version that they all agreed to. And so they'll go specifically, there's a couple of word change in there, but tell why it's important for us to make sure that we do it the right way. In 2008, the state,
I'll remove my objection.
Okay, Representative Wilson removed her objection, so version E is before the committee.
Thank you very much, sorry. In 2008, the state sought EPA approval of its Clean Water Act program. From this, the statutory exclusion for active military ranges under Title 46 was amended so that now excludes the firing or other use of munitions in training activities conducted on active ranges, including active ranges operated by the Department of Defense or military agencies, unless it results in a discharge into waters of the United States. And that's why I brought a lot of help with me today, so they can explain it more carefully. House Bill 185 clarifies Section E7 such that it cannot be misinterpreted to restrict military exercises on ranges other than instances where the Federal Clean Water Act would apply. And we've worked really hard on this. This has been a collaboration between DEC and DMVA, and that's who we have here with us today. And we also have Major Trumbo from the Air Force Region 10 Environmental Office. Hopefully he's still online. And I believe there's probably a few other experts. And since this is really technical, I'm going to leave it up to them to give you the bottom line of this.
Okay, thank you. We have we have Lynn Kent from Department of Environmental Conservation online. Only indicated as questions, and the same for Lindsay Walter of the Department of Law. And then we have McHugh Pierre and General Katkus here to testify. Okay. Is it your intent that you'd like Ms. Pierre and Katkus to testify on the bill, or did you want to direct questions first to one of the other departments?
Mr. Chair, they're my big guns, so yeah, I would appreciate if they could testify first.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner.
I'm just trying to understand the basic function of the bill. Can I just restate it and see if I'm correct, as the sponsor? It's to ensure that military exercises are not restricted except when it would result in discharge of waste into federal waters.
Well, I'm going to give you my interpretation, and then I'm sure the gentleman behind me will correct me. My understanding is right now, as they're doing their training in those areas, if they're shooting and the munition ends up in the waterway, there's a potential for a lawsuit to happen, and this would make that so it could not happen. That's my interpretation. And
okay,
they're kind of nodding, but I'm sure they'll be more explicit than that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Wilson. And General Katkus, would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you're representing for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm Thomas Katkus. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. I'm also the Adjutant General for the Alaska National Guard, representing the state of Alaska today.
Thanks. Would you go ahead and let us know what we think this bill is doing?
Well, I'll start off with real simple. I'm trying to figure out initially why I would be in uniform and coming to you before a Clean Water Act. But I was approached some time ago in my capacity with the military, and as I try to look for different opportunities for the military to come to Alaska, Alaska provides a lot of opportunity. It's well supported by the communities. The people here respect the military. It's a good place to do operations and train. One of the folks that approached me and indicated that there's a potential problem in the training and the development of areas like the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex was the statutes that cover the clean water constraints in Alaska are more restrictive and or vague and can be interpreted more restrictively than the federal requirements. So what we're trying to do here with this bill is not to reduce the constraints or make it weaker than the federal requirements. We're trying to just make the Alaska statute clear so that somebody else who may be taking the military to task in a training area doesn't have the advantage of playing in those vague areas. This clarifies it very much that the constraints of military development in training areas in those capacities are held to the federal standards. So this is just an insertion that specifies exactly what those standards are going to be.
Okay, and before we proceed on, I guess there's been a couple of questions. One is, are we talking, I know there was a problem with white phosphorus shells at Elmendorf or someplace there. And are we talking white phosphorus? Are we talking lead? Are we talking anything? What's the issue before us here?
The issues would be almost any byproduct at all that comes off of the ordnance that are used for training in the training for military. So those military ordinances could be covered that it affects the water. It is going to, in fact, be clarified what the constraints are on the environment. I'm not being very clear on that, so I'm trying
well,
to.
Well, I guess an example might help us. There was a went through court, and there was an order to clean up white phosphorus because there was an impact on ducks and other things, you know, migratory waterfowl. If this change had been in place, does that mean there would not have been an order to clean up that white phosphorus? Or is this other action that we're talking about?
So the U.S. military are very, very good stewards of the environment, and they would have pursued cleaning up the environment whether this was in fact there or not. What this does is as they look forward to developing areas, they don't foresee or can't predict exactly what areas that they're going to be challenged in court for constraining their training. So this clarifies exactly what amendments or what uses of the clean water laws can be used and very much narrows the scope of different groups that may be not that supportive of going forward with training ranges or those developments. So this actually just establishes a standard. Again, not a lesser standard. So.
Okay.
So let me pass this over to McHugh for 1 minute here, sir.
Okay. Mr. Pierre, would you identify yourself on the record and go ahead with your testimony, and then you can come back to the question that I was addressing.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for interrupting you. McHugh Pierre, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs Deputy Commissioner. This does not at all take away from the cleanup or the responsibility of the military, any agency or department thereof, of taking care of the lands in Alaska. That's first and foremost. The white phosphorus you mentioned in Eagle River in that drainage area, that is absolutely going to be cleaned up. It was cleaned up. And what this is doing is just in the future, you can see that the specific language that we're replacing, it says of the United States. Well, that's very, very, very vague. We all know that there's a lot of water of the United States. What specifically are we talking about? Well, we worked with the Department of Law, and we worked with you know, specifically the lawyers that work on DEC issues and Department of the Defense Environmental Section to say, what language are we talking about when we talk about waters of the United States? And that's where we've narrowed it down to 33 USC 1251 through 1376. And we said these are the waters specifically we're mentioning. And we wanted to get as close as we could to determining, okay, if and when development takes place of future military ranges and future munitions, what are we talking about when we say discharge into waters? Because that's where we want to get. We want to narrow, and we want to say, what, when you say you're discharging into waters, be specific as to which waters you're discharging into and why. And that's what we're narrowing into. As you know, there is discharge currently in certain training areas into water, and that all will be cleaned up, is cleaned up, and we plan to do the same thing in the future. It's just a matter of defining that segment, what water is in each training area.
Thank you. Did you have further testimony, or are you ready for questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'm ready for questions. I just wanted to make sure that I know my deputy is much more eloquent than I am in trying to explain some of those areas without getting into a lot of the details on my area. So I apologize for passing it over like I did over to my deputy, but I figured that would be a lot more clear.
Yeah, absolutely fine. People can, we want to get the correct information before us. And we're talking about real details here on when we're describing water to the United States or water to the state of Alaska or navigable waters and those things. And so we've just laid this on the table today. So we're going to hold, we will hold this bill so that people will have a chance to analyze and be able to figure out what we're talking about. But we'll be looking at it very soon. Do people have questions? Any committee member have a question from either of the people testifying? Okay. Seeing none, seeing none at this point in time, we have Major Justin Trumbo. Are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is Major Justin Trumbo, United States Air Force, representing the Department of Defense Regional Environmental Coordinator for Region 10.
Good. We can hear you fine, and thank you for identifying yourself fully there. And would you go ahead with your testimony?
To testify today on this important bill. Again, I'm Major Justin Trumbo. I'm the regional counsel to the Department of Defense for Region 10. In that capacity, I'm the chief environmental legal counsel for state law matters that affect the Department of Defense. And on behalf of the military services in Alaska, we want to express our support for House Bill 185. And I'd like to thank Representative Wilson and her colleagues for their efforts to promote Alaska's continued partnership with the Department of Defense and increasing awareness of our military activities in Alaska. DOD and Alaska do have a long and proud history of cooperation. Alaska's military installations are vital to our worldwide mission. And in the spirit of cooperation, DOD has worked with the Alaska DEC, the Office of the Attorney General, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and General Kakis' staff and other interested stakeholders to develop this amendment. I wanted to point out as background, the statute that's being amended prohibits the disposal of solid or liquid waste into waters or onto lands of the state of Alaska without authorization from the Alaska DEC. As Representative Wilson mentioned, the statute was amended in 2008 when Alaska sought the EPA's approval of its clean water program. And as a result, the statutory exclusion for military ranges was modified so that it now excludes the firing or other use of munitions unless it results into a discharge into waters of the United States. It's that phrase, discharge of into waters of the United States, which has unfortunately created some confusion, and House Bill 185 will hopefully eliminate that. As General Kakis mentioned, this will not repeal any protections under federal law. In fact, it will help ensure military ranges can be used and will be used in accordance with federal law. Moreover, it benefits the state of Alaska in that federal and Alaska state agencies agree that this amendment will not jeopardize continued U.S. EPA approval of Alaska's Clean Water Act program. The benefit of the proposed amendment specifically to the Department of Defense will ensure that questions regarding the application of Alaska law to military ranges are determined in accordance with the Federal Clean Water Act. While there may be uncertainty as to how that Federal Clean Water Act program might apply to military ranges, the proposed amendment won't preclude Alaska agencies, the military, the U.S. EPA, or a private party from making appropriate arguments under the federal statute. But unless amended, the application of the Alaska Clean Water Act to military ranges might be inconsistent with the application of clean water programs to the military and other states. Finally, I did want to point out that because the Alaska DEC plans to apply its clean water program to munitions starting in October of this year, DOD strongly supports HB 185 passing in this 2011 legislative session. In closing, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for this opportunity to testify. This amendment will help ensure that Alaska's continued capacity to host sustainable military readiness training for outstanding airmen soldiers and sailors is not jeopardized, and we welcome the opportunity to provide you with any additional information as you consider this important legislation. Thank you, sir, and that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Major Trumbo. I guess I have a question. It was explained previously that this would not be civilian ranges or other ranges, but as I'm reading page 2, line 17, the exemption is for the firing or other use of munitions in training activities conducted on active ranges, and then it says including active ranges operated by United States DOD. So it appears that that's any training range, whether it is going to be local or state or sport range, if it's an active training range, because that's not defined, because this only says it's including DOD ranges, but it doesn't say that it's limited to DOD ranges. So as you, if you wouldn't mind investigating this and bringing it back to us as a question as to what the military needs and wants, that would be helpful. We might have McHugh Pierre may be able to answer that for us. But if we don't get that answer in the next few minutes, we're going to put this aside. But that's a issue we want to make sure that we're just addressing the areas where we're intending to address. Mr. Pierre?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to remind you that Department of Law is online and could give you some further explanation as to why exactly the wording is put where it is. It's my understanding that the language is written, this part of the statute has not changed, that it's going to be kept in the original statute that you read, including other ranges, but the language that was put in, where it was put in and why, was to impact ranges operated by the Department of Defense or a United States military agency.
I understand that. We'll go to the Department of Law, but what we're modifying is all ranges, because we've left it in that same statute, not in just a DOD range. So, Ms. Walter, are you online?
Yes, I am.
I'm trying to understand how the statute is written here by modifying number 7 on page 2, line 17. Will this change apply to all ranges, since it's modifying the other part that included all ranges before?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's my understanding of this too, that you would read it to apply to both military active ranges and other active ranges.
Okay, thank you, and I want to draw that to the attention of the sponsor so that we can get that is not the intention as was related by the sponsor, so we want to get that clarified, I think. Thank you. Are there other questions? Is there anyone else online to testify on this bill? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I'm still struggling to completely make sure I understand this. And is this what we're effectively doing, is giving primacy to the federal regulations for munitions and active training ranges, the discharge to water?
Through the chair, for the record, McHugh Pierre, Deputy Commissioner, DMVA. No, ma'am. What our goal is to make sure that we specify very clearly in our approving process what waters of the United States we're referring to. So instead of saying, the body of water under EPA's regulation, we want to refer to a specific section that says this is what we're talking about when we're talking about developing future military ranges in the state of Alaska. That way, there's not a wide swath of questioning that would potentially allow or not allow active military use of future ranges, not existing ranges, but future ranges to be permitted.
And Mr. Pierre, since this is a technical question, I know what your intent is, and that's what you're expressing. Let's go to Lynn Kent online, because she's the Department of Conservation. So, Lynn, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am. This is Lynn Kent. I'm the director for the Water Division at Department of Environmental Conservation.
And did you hear Representative Gardner's question?
Yes, I could. Just by way of background in response to that question about what ranges are included or not included, it was long before DEC sought primacy for the permitting program from the Environmental Protection Agency, it was already legislatively mandated policy of the state to exempt training ranges, including military ranges, from the requirements to get a state permit or a state discharge permit. We revised this statute a little bit when we took on primacy for the federal program because in certain circumstances, ranges may require a permit under the Clean Water Act. And so we included this phrase of unless it results in a discharge into waters of the United States. What we learned is that that language could have the effect of requiring a state permit under state law, even if it wasn't required under the Federal Water Pollution Control Act or the Federal Clean Water Act. So what's being proposed today, this new language, would very clearly exempt all of these ranges, training ranges and military ranges, from the permitting requirement that we used to have under state law, or that was similar to what we had under state law, unless it's required by the Clean Water Act. And this proposed language is consistent with the Clean Water Act and consistent with EPA's approval of our program and would not result in any adverse impact on the program that we're operating right now under the EPA primacy.
Okay, thank you. And Lynn, can you send to us the definitions and kind of the descriptions of what's the different waters that we're talking about, what's exempt, what's not exempt? It would be easier for us to look at those, and we'll have it for consideration before our next hearing on this bill. I think we are planning to do that rapidly. There's not an intention to hold this for a long period of time, but we do want to understand what we're doing, and we want to give the public chance to understand what we are doing and comment. So we have Representative Feigin and Representative Wilson, and then we'll put this bill aside for today.
Okay, no, I don't know.
Okay, Representative Wilson?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question, and I'm sure someone here can answer it. Exactly what is an active range? I mean, do we have a lot of ranges that are inactive, and so this is only on active ranges? What's the definition of an active or an inactive range?
And are you wanting the DOD active range or any active range?
Yeah.
And is that different if it's DOD or private? If you know the answer to this, the full complete.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the record, McHugh Pierre, DMVA. I'll give you our interpretation and then let Department of Law share the whole picture there. But our view of this, and Representative Wilson, Representative Tammy Wilson has been a fantastic partner in this effort because she has so much military in her district and she knows the importance of the economic value of the military to our state. As the military looks to expand its role in Alaska for training and to provide a more unique joint force opportunity in the state, it looked at our laws and said, okay, well, how do we develop a new range, and where would we do it, and why would we do it, and what are we going to be impacted by, and what causes some concern and what doesn't? Obviously, the lack of specificity in this current statute that we're talking about was raised as a concern. An active range is something that is currently being used and will be used in the future. There are ranges that have been abandoned. At DMVA, we have ranges that are National Guard that have been abandoned, and we receive money from National Guard Bureau, which is a section of Department of Defense, to clean up those ranges, to remove all the lead bullets, to remove the contaminated dirt, to appropriately clean them up to the standards that we expect in our backyard to be okay, and DEC makes sure that takes place. So it won't be for abandoned ranges or ranges that will be reused, because that's a whole new permitting process, but this is for active ranges that are currently being used and will be used in the future.
Representative Wilson.
So are all of these that we're talking about military then?
through the chair, Representative Wilson, our concern is for military ranges. However, the chairman accurately pointed out, it looks to read that civilian ranges could be impacted as well. So we want to work with the chair and with DEC to make sure that we do everything right and that we meet the intent of the language. So.
And what we'll do is we'll ask the Department of Law to send us in writing a description of what an active range definition means, and if somebody starts using a range, is that already exempt? Because as soon as you start using it, it's active, and do you need a permit before using a civilian range or not? Those are the kind of issues that they should lay out. So, Ms. Walter, are you still online? We'll send that to the Department of Law and ask them to lay that out for us as well. So with that, we'll put this bill aside, and we have House Bill 106 back before us, and we had a presentation which we got most of the way through. Actually, we just put the last few slides on the screen so we could see them, and they would be available for the public, and we'll go back through and see if we have any further questions on this. And again, our intention of this today is to go through the conversation with on the program and a representative of the districts, or some of the districts, who is here not representing a particular district but was asked to make the presentation from the district's perspective. And we will intend to have the department come in, and if there are differences in their view versus the view we're getting from the districts, that will be actually helpful, because if the districts and the department are seeing the program in different lights, we'll figure that out next week and then know maybe how to work on some more of the problems. Welcome. Would you go ahead and identify yourself on the record, and we'll go back to where we are in the slides.
Thank you, Co-Chair Seaton, members of the Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Gray. And before I go over the last three slides, I'd like to make a correction to a statement I made on Wednesday, and that was about hard rock mining. I think I believe I said that it was up to each individual landowner to have the restrictions. And I wanted to give credit to Representative Feige, who was correct in saying there are some uniform provisions throughout the state. And so if it's a hard rock mine, a development project, you would need to get a plan of operations and a reclamation plan from DNR, no matter who the landowner was. So I wanted to make sure that clear up that I made a mistake there.
Thank you.
And the last three slides, one was just a summary of some of the effects that I think are of concern to many of the coastal districts. Probably right up there up top is the inability to have a meaningful enforceable policies. One point I didn't really make at the last meeting is that the coastal program, as it was set up in 1977, I believe, and as well as the 2003 changes, it's a cooperative program between the state of Alaska and the coastal districts. So the coastal districts aren't just another stakeholder. They are, with the state agencies, they implement the program. The other thing of concern to many people is the DEC carve-out. And I think one of the reasons why is that it's just very confusing to almost everyone. The scope of review is not always clear, especially if there's a federal permit involved. It sometimes gets confusing what you're reviewing. Almost every coastal resource or use is affected in some way by water quality, so that adds to the confusion. Another concern that's been expressed is the centralized decision-making, that moving the program to one agency and having all decisions made by one agency has been of concern to some folks, and I think even the legislative audit brought up that that's led to a lot of opportunities for consensus building during project reviews. And the next two slides are just some thoughts I had from talking with some of the districts about possible statutory changes and possible regulatory changes. First, for the enforceable policies, there have been some differences in opinion of what the statutes actually mean. So the statutes could be clarified to make that a little more clear. I had a chance to look at the work draft, and at least in my opinion, I think that would make it a little more clear. And I don't think any districts are asking to remove some of the other provisions, for instance, about uses of state concern, that you cannot arbitrarily or unreasonably affect those. The other issue is just about the centralization of power. There might be some things that can be done for checks and balances. In the work draft, it looks as if there would be an appeals board, regulatory board, and that might be one way to do it, looking at where else the agency might be, maybe in a third non-partial, impartial agency. Elevations, they could be decided by all three resource commissioners like they did in the past, or in the work draft, it looks like that would be something that would go to the appeals board. And in the DEC carve-out, by eliminating that, and that would be something that would be, I think, supported by the federal 312 evaluation in 2008. I also believe the legislative audit recommended that DNR look into some options to eliminate the carve-out. And indeed, in DNR's own draft bill in 2008, it would have eliminated the carve-out. One thing I didn't talk much about, but I think this was not a purposeful change, but in 2003, when the DEC carve-out was made, it eliminated all possibilities for public comment on the DEC finding when it does not have a permit. So an example of that might be OCS reviews or federal activities. I should hand it to DEC because I believe they did come up with a good process, but there's nothing in regulation that would require them to do so. So for some of the recent exploration projects in the OCS, DEC was at the table for those reviews, but they weren't necessarily required to have any kind of a public process. And then with the timeline, it seems to me that particularly the 90-day timeline is a problem when there's a large project with a lot of unresolved issues. And it looks as if the work draft would address that by making an exemption for projects with an EIS. So most large projects will have an EIS, so that might solve that concern. And last slide is some possible regulatory changes. So in other words, you wouldn't necessarily need statutes to make these changes, but unless there's some commitment on DNR, there's no guarantee that these changes would be made. So I believe some of these might be addressed in your work draft. One is to eliminate the designated area requirement. If you were to do this in statute or regulation, there still would be the opportunity for designated areas if a district wanted a special management area. But this would eliminate that tie between the enforceable policies having to have a designated area first. A tremendous amount of funds have been spent on these designated areas and mapping, state time to review them, and they were the topic of several of the mediations. Enforceable policies, I believe some of the problems could be fixed just by a different interpretation of the regulatory language, or perhaps changing some of that also. And lastly, with the statewide standards, as I mentioned, with just one example on the habitat standard, where it used to cover the entire coastal zone, now it only covers a small part of the coastal zone. That's the same for several other standards. So that could easily be fixed in regulation. And perhaps, of course, there's difference of opinion on this, but you could reinstate a mineral standard to be able to look at mining impacts under its own standard. And with that, I'm available for any questions anyone might have.
Okay, thank you, Glenn. And you did get the PowerPoint, didn't you, Representative Diff?
Yes.
With the flow charts and all. There were a couple of questions that were brought up earlier about the prescriptive versus performance based. Can you kind of go over that prescriptive requirement for the enforceable policies and how that would differ from a performance-based standard?
And one way to look at this might be looking at the current statewide standards. I might go out on a limb here to say every one of them, or at least almost every one of them, is performance-based or some kind of a process.
Performance-based or prescriptive?
Performance-based. Either performance-based or a process-based statewide standard. And what that does is it gives a lot of flexibility to how you will meet that standard. When you look at a specific district enforceable policy, I gave an example last time of a floating facility where I gave an actual policy that said that you, how many feet the tide would be and things like that. That would be prescriptive. A performance-based would be saying that the that dock or the floating facility can never bottom ground on the bottom. And then it would be up to the applicant to decide how to do that. Maybe there's more ways than you could do that than would be in the prescription. Give another example maybe on the North Slope. They had a proposed policy for avoiding impacts to bowhead whales. And so they had a specific decibel level that would be measured so many miles from the activity. And so their policy said you cannot exceed that decibel level at, I'm just going to say 15 miles. I don't recall the exact number of miles. And they had a decibel number there. That's a prescriptive. So the company absolutely has to do that no matter what. Now, performance-based would be more something like at 15 miles from the source of the noise, there will be no deflection of whales or 10% deflection, something like that. So then it would be up to the industry to figure out how to meet that. And there are plenty of other examples, but I think generally, at least when I was working with the oil industry, they liked these performance-based stipulations or policies because that gave them some flexibility through technology changes or whatever. They were sometimes able to really meet the intent of the policy without meeting the actual prescription in the policy.
Okay, and so did I understand? I think I was confused when you said at first. You said the statewide standards are almost all performance-based.
Yeah, performance-based or process-based. Right?
Okay, and the local district policies are required to be prescriptive.
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Thanks. Any questions on this by anybody? And we were going through your... On slide 7 there, where the requirement of conflicts, this was on adequately addressed. And did you provide those citations to us from the Attorney General memorandum or the ACMP program description approved by NOAA?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite. I have not. I will do that right afterwards.
Okay. If you could do that, that would be helpful just so we'd see that. We may have those in here, but if we could have the direct citation to those, then we can follow those up. I guess we had some questions on I see your notes here, the conference notes, and that was a change. Requirements for the subsistence. So that is on looking at page 9.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where we had different requirements changed over time after the program was there while the districts were trying to do their enforceable policies. So I'm just trying to make clear what this document is. So this document, the March 17th document that says Alaska Coastal Management Program changing requirements for subsistence use designations. Those are examples showing where these arrows are and where the changes were and giving us some documentation that the changes took place.
And Mr. Chairman, yes, I spent a few hours yesterday going through my records to get the actual documentation. That's a summary of the documents. And the one point I should make is that a lot of the meetings were not taped, and a lot of the direction was verbal, oral. So unless you send a follow-up email saying this is what we understood, you know, was the direction in this meeting, you had no written record. And on several occasions as a consultant, I did that and wanted to just get the okay. Did I understand this meeting correctly? And the response I got on at least two occasions was, no, we're not going to go back through all your points and clarify whether or not you got it right. So I do, what I gave you is what I could find in some document or another, but a lot of this was verbal, and it's there is no record, really, other than notes.
Sure, thank you. And Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why is it unreasonable to expect DECON to not change the regulations? It seems like a natural evolution of regulations would be expected in the normal process of regulating things like the coastal management program.
And through the chair, I didn't mean to give that impression. I think, not speaking for any specific district, but I think the districts would have welcomed some changes to the regulations for a while now and would certainly welcome changes. But I personally, I haven't heard any commitment to make any changes other than to the consistency review regulations, the 110 regulations.
Follow up, Representative Feige.
Well, specifically on the requirement for maps, you're complaining that DECOM continues to basically ask for more and more detail in terms of, you know, larger and larger map scales. It seems to me that that's not unreasonable. Yes, it costs money, but, you know, these boroughs that we're talking about are not destitute.
And through the chair, thank you for bringing that up, Representative Feige, because I did get a call from someone at DECOM yesterday saying that they are going to, they're in the process of changing that map scale. But at least from my personal opinion, I would say that it is unreasonable. I think you would be talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars for some of these boroughs, even a borough like the North Slope. That's significant. A coastal resource service area, I think the third largest is the Bering Straits. They get a $75,000 grant each year for everything. That's travel, employment of the program director, everything. And this is the first year they really got a full grant. So unless they got special funding, and I would think it would, to really do it right, it would take hundreds of thousands of dollars to do that kind of a study, since there is none there now.
And I guess, you know, I don't have any problems with going through a regulatory process and making changes. I think that what we're looking at here is the example is they were told to how to write their enforceable policies to make them consistent with the statewide standards and the requirement for enforceable policies. But over time, as they went through the process of creating an enforceable policy, then the requirements for writing the enforceable policy changed, and therefore you're always trying to develop a plan that is required and a policy that's required, but if the requirements for that policy keep changing, then that's where a lot of the frustration has come from the districts. And that was, I appreciate you giving me an example here, but that has been something that's been expressed by numerous districts to us over the last several years, and I don't think I've ever met you until about 2 weeks ago when we were looking for someone that could present the enforceable policy or the district's perspectives. Let's see. Do committee members have any other questions? Do everyone understand how the consistency review process works from the aspect or as seen by the districts? Representative Pike.
Just a question for Mr. Gray. Have you been working actively to make statutory changes to the ACMP?
Through the chair, I really have no means to do that. Occasionally, Abe will give me a call, and I'll give my opinion, but I didn't prepare this bill, no.
I didn't ask you that. I asked, have you been actively trying to lobby for changes to the ACMP regulations?
And through the chair, I'm not a lobbyist, so I don't lobby, but I have been promoting changes, yes, absolutely.
How much time have you dedicated?
Follow up.
How much time have you dedicated to that?
Through the chair, I don't even know how to make a guess at that. It's a small part of what I do. Right now I have 7 different contracts with coastal communities, not all on coastal zone issues, so my day is pretty full.
Thank you. And I wanted to bring for the committee's attention to make sure that everybody understood there's 2 other pieces of paper here on your desk. One of them is the House Bill 106 work draft version B bullet points. So those just go through and generally tell us exactly what our what the CS that we have before us, what it does in general terms, and each of the changes. And then the other is the sectional on the work draft that we have on the table before us as well. So are there any other questions from anybody before we change the date? Thank you for coming back and finishing the presentation. And it is, oh, look at that, 2:59, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.